Whenever I think of the Sadducees, I think of that silly kids song that I learned at camp many years ago, and we sang it one time here at First Church for the kids' song. The refrain goes, I only want to be a sheep, ba, 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 ba. Remember that one? I only want to be a sheep, ba, 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 ba. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. I only want to be a sheep. And then on each of the verses, it mentions a biblical character that we don't so much want to be like. The one is, I don't want to be a goat. Nope. As in like the sheep and the goats, right? I don't want to be a Pharisee because they are not fair, you see. And then there's the verse, I don't want to be a Sadducee because they are so sad, you see. So that's why I think of the song, right? So I hear about the Sadducees, and I think about that goofy song, the sad, sad Sadducees. Now, we don't know very much about the Sadducees. They were a group of religious leaders in the time of Jesus, a different group from the Pharisees that we hear about much more often in the Gospels. What we do know is that the Sadducees were part of the priestly aristocracy. They had status and power. The historian Josephus described them as harsh judges who were known to be most cruel among the Jews. And several times in the Gospels and in the book of Acts, there are indications that the Sadducees disagreed with the Pharisees on a significant theological point. The Sadducees did not believe in resurrection. I suppose for them, when you were dead, and that was all. Kind of sad, don't you think? Kind of sad to think that when this life is over, that that could just be it. I don't want to be a Sadducee, because they're so sad, you see. Well, in today's gospel story, the Sadducees are not making the most of their limited time in the world. Instead, they are spending their time and their energy arguing with Jesus about the resurrection. They suggest a situation in which a woman ends up being married to seven men in succession as she is widowed over and over. When the woman finally dies as well, they want to know whose wife she will be in the afterlife. After all, she was married to seven different men. I suppose they ask the question to try to trick Jesus. To try to make his beliefs sound stupid, to try to make his convictions about the resurrection sound crazy. But Jesus' wise answer points out that they are the ones who are being silly. Though Jesus probably doesn't know any more than any of us about what heaven will be like, he quite confidently declares that marriage is not even a relevant issue when it comes to the afterlife. And then he goes on to address the issue that is really behind their question, the fact that they don't believe that there will be an afterlife. This is an unusual text in the Gospel of Luke, because Jesus doesn't tend to do a lot of theologizing. He doesn't usually tell his followers which theological doctrines they should believe and which they should reject. Most of the time, Jesus' teaching has more to do with how to live in the world, how to love one another, including the poor and the outcast and the lowly ones. And Jesus not only teaches that value, but he also demonstrates it in the way he lives his life, in his healing and helping and forgiving ministry. But it makes sense to me to think that Jesus must have had a great deal of confidence and hope that when his life in the world came to an end, it would not be the end, full stop. He wasn't worried about death, and so he had the freedom to live fully. He could take risks. He could make friends with sinners. He could heal lepers. He could even argue with powerful Sadducees if he needed to. Because Jesus must have known deep within him that his life and his death were in the hands of a loving God. I think of the Thessalonian Christians and the worries and concerns that they have that the Apostle Paul addresses in his letter to them. Like the Sadducees, they were getting distracted by theological questions that were keeping them from living lives of faithfulness and goodness. While the Sadducees were spending their time arguing about whether there was life after death, the Thessalonians were worrying or perhaps debating about whether Jesus had already returned and the world was coming to an end. And so Paul wrote to them to set them straight and to get them back on track in their lives of faith. He comforted them and encouraged them to continue in faith, not by giving them any proof, but simply by reminding them of their identity as God's chosen ones, and of the promise of glory because of God's grace in Jesus Christ. It wasn't just a matter of helping the Thessalonian Christians to feel better. It was a matter of them being freed from fear and anxiety and worry so that they could focus their attention on living fully in the way of Jesus. Paul prays not only that God will comfort them, but that God will strengthen them in every good work and word. The short passage today from the book of Job provides another good example. Job has lost everything, if you remember how the story goes. He's lost his family, his home, his possessions, his health and well-being. But he clings to his faith in God. Even after everything else has disappeared, everything has gone wrong, he holds on to God, trusting that even though he is going through terrible hardships now, that his life is still in the hands of his faithful and loving God. And that is my prayer for our church today. I'm not really too worried about whether we all believe the right doctrines perfectly, or whether we agree on every detail. But we do need to stand firm and hold fast to what we have seen and heard in Jesus Christ. Following his way, we need to live in such confidence and hope and trust in God that we are able to live freely, giving our time and our talent and ourselves for others, and not being held back by worry or fear about the future. Yesterday, a small group of church members gathered here at the church to think and pray and consider what God may be calling us to do next in our ministry. We strive to be a welcoming and hospitable congregation. And we hope that people in our community will want to come and join us in worship and service, fellowship and care for one another in this church community. But likely no one will come unless we invite them. And many others won't even respond to an invitation. So we're going to need to go out and meet people where they are, sharing the love and grace and comfort of Christ with our neighbors in creative and courageous ways. We talked about what it might look like to offer radical hospitality, not only in our church, but in our neighborhood. We talked about who are our neighbors in this community, and we shared ideas about how we might connect with them and what God may be calling us to do as a next step. In that conversation, there were four particular neighbors or particular groups of people who are our neighbors that arose and we lifted up. The first one was Indigenous neighbors. Second was, these are in no particular order actually, second was newcomers to Canada in our community. Then there were seniors in our community. And finally, we thought about the people who meet in our building, right here in our church, to participate in 12-step groups or other groups that come and share our space. The ideas that we came up with, which I won't share with you this morning, will be shared with session and considered some more, and there will probably be some proposals or a few proposals arising from it. But one thing is certain. No matter which direction we choose or how we decide to stretch ourselves in going out beyond our church building to meet our neighbors and connect with them and share the love of God in word or deed, we do not engage in this mission because we have all the answers and we want to impart them to our neighbors who know little of or to nothing of love, life, God, or their place in the world. Like Job, we likely still wonder about why bad things continue to happen to good people. Like the Sadducees, we aren't completely sure about what happens after we die. How could we be? Like the Thessalonian Christians, we get alarmed and upset sometimes too when troubles continue, when wars rage on, and we wonder when God is going to finally come again to bring peace. But like Paul, we endeavor to speak words of comfort and encouragement to one another and to our neighbors who are sad or scared or worried or alone. Like Jesus, we give our time and our attention towards those who may be on the margins, those who are sick or suffering or left out. Like Job, we cling to our faith in the God of love to sustain us through our own struggles, our questions and doubts. And in a spirit of humility, as beggars telling others where food is to be found, we reach out to our neighbors and point to life in Christ. We put our own concerns and priorities aside for a time, and with confidence and hope in God's love and God's promises and God's presence, we give ourselves to the ministry of hospitality in the neighborhood. Jesus' life and death and resurrection is our eternal comfort and our good hope. May God comfort our hearts and strengthen them in every good work and word.